This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Walmart really shapes a lot of our economy and has, you know, enormous power in terms of how things are organized and certainly in terms of what it does. And I think it, you know, it bears responsibility for its own actions.
Walmart, what does the name of the world's largest retailer evoke for you? Do you think of its reputation as a poor employer and its anti-union tactics? Do you lump it in your mind with other large corporations who worship profit at the expense of environmental and social justice? Or perhaps you're among those who respect Walmart's more recent initiatives to improve its environmental impact, cut back on energy use, and reduce packaging. Today on Sea Change Radio, we begin a two-part series in which I'll speak with two writers for whom the name Walmart evokes very different things. This week, I talk with author, researcher, and advocate Stacy Mitchell, who recently published a six-part series for Grist on Walmart's sustainability efforts. Mitchell believes that the company's purported efforts to improve its sustainability profile are mostly window dressing, a ploy to change the media narrative of Walmart's poor track record without actually changing its overall negative global impact. Next week, we'll hear a contrasting opinion from reporter Mark Gunther, who's written extensively on Walmart as well. Gunther is more impressed by the company's sustainability efforts, believing that the perfect should not be the enemy of the good, and that when a giant like Walmart makes moves toward environmental responsibility, it's worth taking notice. But first, my discussion with Stacy Mitchell.
Take it easy.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Stacy Mitchell. Stacy's a senior researcher with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She's also the author of Big Box Swindle. Stacy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be with you.
The media has been quite glowing in its coverage of Walmart's sustainability efforts over the last 5-6 years. Can you catch our listeners up on what their efforts have been and what the media coverage of this has been?
Well, Walmart introduced the sustainability campaign in late 2005, and it was a time when they were really facing a lot of criticism. They were facing opposition to their store development proposals in large numbers of cities. There was a growing number of places that were looking at legislation to change their practices, particularly around labor issues. Just everywhere they turned, there was a lot of criticism and a lot of pushback against their business model. And the sustainability campaign really seems to have been their way of trying to change the conversation. And they've, you know, succeeded to a large degree. I mean, back in 2005, poll numbers showed that Walmart had like almost a 40% unfavorable rating, which is enormous if you're a company trying to reach the public and you've got 40% of people who don't like you. Now that's down to about 20%. And what they have done with the sustainability initiative is they, you know, they've laid out a set of goals and they've done this sort of series of announcements. And so much of the press coverage, if you look back at it, and there's been a lot of it, both in the mainstream media, but also in, you know, environmental blogs and other more focused kinds of publications. And what they have done is most of the coverage has really been around what Walmart says it's going to do. So they've got this goal of being supplied by 100% renewable energy. And that goal has been repeated in literally thousands of news stories. And it sounds great. But what I found is that not a single one of those news stories that I looked through so much actually reported on what percentage of their electricity is coming from renewables. And as it turns out, it's only about 2%. I mean, it's really a minuscule amount. And at the current pace that they've been adding solar and wind, it would take them 300 years to get to that 100% goal. So all of this, as I was saying, there's been a lot of coverage and a lot of it very good for Walmart's image, and they've gotten a lot of benefit out of it. But there hasn't been that sort of stepping back and really looking and doing the critical analysis and seeing, well, what is it that, you know, yeah, they're saying this, but what have they actually accomplished and and more importantly, what are they not talking about? I mean, I think that's my other big criticism of the media covering this, is that there are lots of aspects of Walmart's environmental footprint that just aren't on the table. That Walmart has said, oh, here's what we mean by sustainability, and the news media has completely taken their cue from Walmart instead of saying, well, what is it? What are some of the impacts of this retailer that it's not doing anything about or that it's not even mentioning?
Because it takes real journalism. It can't just be something in a syndicated AP piece or a press release. And a lot of journalism, unfortunately, is regurgitating what's fed to them. It sounds, though, that you've done a lot more sleuthing than the average journalist. This is obviously a passion of yours. You're not only you've not only written a book about big box retailers, you're also dedicated to doing grassroots advocacy work to try to mitigate the impact of some of these big box retailers on local levels. You did a little sleuthing with that 100% claim for renewable energy, and you came up with 2%. Walk us back through the 2% and what that means, really. I was interested in how that might compare to a Target or a Costco. Do you have any idea?
Right. So I should say that the 2% is, and it's the number I used, I said it's less than 2%. And my calculation actually showed it was less than 1%, but I wanted to be conservative. So I went with 2%. And I based that on some of the information that Walmart has put out about the amount of solar panels that it's put on stores. It also buys wind power from Texas. And those are its two main sources of renewable energy. And so based on some information they'd put out about the size of those purchases and about the amount of solar that they'd installed, it was possible to figure out what share of their overall electricity use is coming from solar and wind. I should also add that there's a certain amount of background renewable energy, if you will, that's on the grid. Nationally, it's about 6%. So we all are using some level of renewable energy, and Walmart, of course, also as well. But the 2% is what they've actually installed, and the sort of time frame that it would take them in terms of the hundreds of years to get to 100% renewable energy.
I'm sure they have some commercials that are talking about touting their efforts in the alternative energy space. They are also contributing almost down the line to Republican climate change denying politicians.
This was another area where, again, there's been no reporting on this, but Walmart got a lot of kudos for coming out with a public statement in favor of climate change legislation. And that sort of got me thinking about their campaign contributions. One of the other things that they did, 6-7 years ago when they were facing so much public negativity, is that they ramped up the amount of money that they were giving to politicians. And so they've now become one of the largest political donors in terms of corporations in the country. And I found that a huge share of their money is going to politicians that have really bad track records on the environment in terms of the National Conservation Voters scorecard. So I looked at both their federal and their state giving. I found, for example, that, in the 2007 and 2008 election cycle, 80% of their Senate campaign contributions went to senators who helped block the cap and trade bill that was proposed that year. They've similarly, their giving in the House has been a little bit more balanced between Democrats and Republicans. But if you look, they tend to give to Democrats who vote more like Republicans on environmental issues, including Democrats that voted against against the cap and trade bill in the House. And at the state level, it's even more extreme. I think that is one of the people don't tend to look as much at the giving at the state level. But if you look at where, Walmart's, top recipients of Walmart's campaign cash, it is, a number of governors who are leading deniers of climate change. It's also Governor of Pennsylvania, who's been an advocate for the fracking industry. I mean, just sort of, everywhere you look, their campaign money is going to lawmakers who are blocking really important kinds of environmental legislation.
To look around. Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking with author and researcher Stacy Mitchell. So let's assume Walmart is not going away anytime soon. How can they be part of the solution instead of just part of the problem? How can they really improve instead of quote-unquote greenwashing?
I think that it really depends on how you frame the question. And I think that the environmental, or I should say many environmentalists, have tended to frame the question around Walmart in terms of, here you have this big company, they're obviously not going to go away, so, or at least anytime soon. So anything that they do to reduce their environmental footprint is a good thing. And we should help them and sort of cheer them along in doing that. And that seems really, I think, compelling and sensible on the surface. But the argument that I would make is that that's really the wrong way to frame the issue. That the real question, what that really misses is that what sustainability is for Walmart is that it's a growth strategy. Walmart adopted sustainability at a time when it was really facing its growth being cut off by public opposition, and it has used sustainability to turn that around and has really ramped up its growth machine in the years since. Since Walmart initiated its sustainability campaign in 2005, it's expanded its U.S. operations by 35%. I mean, it's added millions of square feet of stores. And it's selling 35% more stuff than it was in 2005. And it's also growing quite rapidly around the world. I think the question that we need to ask is that, you know, is Walmart's ability to take over a larger and larger share of the U.S. and the global economy good for the planet? And I think the answer is undeniably that it's not. And I think what environmentalists have to step back and ask themselves is, are we helping Walmart grow? And I think that that's what is happening.
Does Walmart ever take a step back, do you think, internally and think, maybe we should just try to improve the stores that we have? It seems like it's a never-ending growth model, though.
Yeah, and it's, you know, obviously they're not the only company. I mean, that's sort of the way that our system has been set up.
But not traditionally. This is only the last few decades that it's a constant, this never-ending thirst for growth.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And Walmart is very much a product of public policy, you know. So I guess, you know, we've long advocated that we need to sort of go back to looking at, you know, land use policy, economic development policy, tax policy. I mean, we have really, you know, as a society, we have created big box retailers. And they have grown to their size in part because they're efficient only to the degree that a lot of the costs that they create are borne by the public at large and by the environment. And so, you know, public policy, I think, can be a tool to level that playing field. And I think that would change the dynamic. So that's really my sort of idea of what the solution has to be, is that we need to develop a different kind of economy, one that is truly more sustainable. And Walmart is sort of the diametric opposite of at least what I think of as being a truly sustainable economy. So I don't think, I think the issue with why I think the growth issue is so central is that as Walmart grows, it completely wipes out all the gains that it has made. So Walmart, for example, has as part of its pledge, it reduced the amount of electricity that its U.S. stores use by 10%. Well, since then, it's built so many new stores that it's actually using far more electricity. Its greenhouse gas emissions are going up and not down. And so that's one problem with the growth. But the other problem with the growth is that as Walmart expands, as it takes over more of the economy, for example, in the food sector, Walmart captures one out of every $4 that Americans spend on groceries. And in some metro areas, it captures one out of every $2 that people spend on groceries. As Walmart expands, it begins to squeeze out other enterprises, other businesses that in many cases are more sustainable and have more capacity to be sustainable over the long term than this huge company with its global supply chain does.
It's really quite a meteoric rise as well. I had no idea that it had expanded as much as it had in the last decade and a half. You write that it was only 23 years ago that Walmart opened its first supercenter. That's a store with a full supermarket inside. But by 1998, it was still relatively modest with 441 supercenters. That's relatively modest, and about 6% of U.S. grocery sales. That's 1998. But since then, now the supercenter count has climbed to 3,000, and Walmart captured 25% of the $550 billion Americans spent on groceries last year. That's staggering.
It is. We've never had a retailer like this before in our history. And when you capture 25% of the food market, and they capture over 10% of everything else, then you have this unprecedented power to dictate, you know, how things are made and where things come from. It's astounding, really, how much they have grown.
And most people would think that this is a large public company still, but it's really owned by it's a small fiefdom, really. It's a one family with that owns almost 50% and soon possibly over 50% of the company. Give us an idea of the Walton family's wealth.
So the Waltons are the heirs to Walmart. Sam Walton founded Walmart almost 50 years ago. And this is his wife and his kids and grandkids and so forth are the Waltons. They own 49% of Walmart, which just is astounding. I mean, Walmart's bigger than most countries, you know, in terms of being the sort of size of its revenue. And 49% owned by this one single family. The Waltons have more wealth than the bottom 30% of all Americans combined.
Give us a little bit more of an idea of how much they've invested in sustainability.
You know, the series on in Grist used the phrase greenwash as the kind of title. Walmart's greenwash is the title for this series. And in a way, it's not exactly greenwash, at least not in the sort of conventional sense of how companies do this. It's more complex and clever, really, than that. You know, there's enough substance mixed in with the spin to sort of draw you in. And Walmart can post really big numbers. I mean, Walmart, you know, Walmart's now recycling its hangers, you know, and it recycles 30 tons of plastic hangers every month, you know, and it sounds like, wow, well, that's a good thing. But if we don't step back and look at the bigger picture, and if we don't recognize how praising Walmart for the hangers without having any, you know, discussion of their larger environmental impacts is really heading in the wrong direction in the long term because of their ability to use that more favorable image to grow. And I think that's really been pretty clear that they've been able to do that. I think the things that, you know, Walmart would, you know, that they often talk about are the energy efficiency. I mentioned they've reduced energy use at their U.S. stores by 10% or so. And they would talk about the recycling. They're recycling more of the, you know, the cardboard and the other kind of waste that's generated at their stores. And they would talk some about the things that they're doing with some of the factories in China where they're helping those factories become more energy efficient. I think those would be some of the main things that they would talk about. And again, looked at narrowly, you can't really argue that any of those things are bad. But again, when you step back from any of them, it really starts to complicate the picture. And I think this is, you know, something that we, you know, we all need to wrestle with. I mean, take the Chinese factories. Yes, there have been a couple hundred Chinese factories that have had energy efficiency improvements by working with Walmart. But Walmart sources from tens of thousands of factories in China who haven't had those energy efficiency improvements. And what one of the pieces that I wrote about was sort of about, you know, if we, you know, Walmart really has an investment in the cycle of consumption. You know, their whole business model is built on this idea of getting the churn of products that we go through to speed up and for us to go through more and more products. So they cheapen the quality of merchandise. And so instead of buying, you know, one pair of jeans that will last for, you know, however long, you're now, those jeans are wearing out much more quickly and you're having to buy many more pairs. And this is the effect that Walmart has really had on the overall quality of products.
I've been shopping, y'all, shopping. I bought my mind and soul on the river. Yeah, yeah. I bought my heart in Nashville, Tennessee.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author and researcher Stacy Mitchell. Apple has been in the news lately because their supply chain involves Foxconn, which is an enormous electronics manufacturer in China, which has been the subject of a lot of human rights abuses. Walmart and Apple are sitting on some of the largest corporate nest eggs the world has ever seen. What could they do to change this dynamic? I assume that their argument would be, we want to just get the lowest prices to our consumer. That seems to be their get out of jail free card.
You know, and I think their argument would probably also be, well, all of our competitors are, you know, behaving the same way, Target, Home Depot, and certainly that's very much true. I guess, you know, for me, I tend to want to take that question in a very different direction, which is to say, what is it about the failure of our public policy that, you know, you look at the, you know, in terms of the reporting that we've now seen on some of the conditions in Apple factories where you've got, you know, people living in these dormitories and working 12 hours a day. I mean, it's a sort of serfdom, right? And obviously, American workers can't compete with that unless we all want to become serfs too. And so, you know, how is it that we have a global trading policy that doesn't sort of account in some way for those things, that doesn't allow countries maybe to set some limits or some rules about what gets imported in ways that don't undercut their own workforce and that don't support a kind of economic conditions for other people that that are not part of our values as a nation. And so, you know, and with the question of Walmart, you know, again, it's like, what could Walmart do? Well, you know, I mean, it doesn't talk at all about its land development practices. You know, Walmart, one of the things that is curiously absent from all of its sustainability reports and the press releases it puts out and so forth, it never mentions land use, never mentions the stores that it builds. And many of the stores that Walmart builds are on wetlands. They obviously consume an enormous amount of acreage. I mean, you can't think of a kind of building footprint for retail that is more than a Walmart store, a big single story with a moat of parking. There are all kinds of environmental consequences that go with that pattern of development, and yet Walmart is completely silent on it. So that's, you know, maybe they should take a pledge not to to develop one more acre of undeveloped land. You know, that would be a great thing to do. But I guess, you know, as I said, my inclination is always to go back to the policy arena and say, well, maybe we need to have land use policies that that are focused on building more compact and less auto-oriented kinds of communities. And I think one of the problems that, you know, we have in this mindset of thinking, well, what is it that corporations ought to do? Is that, you know, we have allowed corporations really to become so powerful in this country. They exercise an enormous amount of power over our political process through their campaign contributions and their lobbying. And to me, that's really the big issue. And I think that's a huge obstacle to environmental progress. So I think we need to get corporations out of political donations. I think we need to change Citizens United. I think we need to break up some of these big companies in order to reduce their power so that we as citizens can start to set some direction in this country, both at the local and national level. And to me, that's really the path forward in terms of addressing some of these issues about labor and environment that are so critical.
Orville Schell, the sinologist, has a terrific piece in The Atlantic that came out recently entitled How Walmart is Changing China. I don't know if you've read it.
Yeah.
And he describes Walmart as, quote, a corporate entity larger in scope and logistical complexity than any other in human history. Were they always so anti-labor in terms of unions? Could you walk us through how that's evolved or as some may say, devolved?
They've always been a strongly anti-union company. I think when Sam Walton, the founder, was around, that there was somewhat more of a camaraderie and sort of respect for the employees that I think has disappeared completely. But they've always been bent on paying the lowest possible wages and keeping unions out. I mean, when Walmart first opened its first few stores in Arkansas, they actually took advantage of a loophole that allowed them not to pay minimum wage. They paid half of minimum wage and mostly hired wives of farmers who were kind of desperate and didn't really have any other prospects. So that kind of squeezing your workforce has really been with the company from the beginning. Although, as I said, I think it did have, in terms of the kind of way that the company interacted with its workforce, it wasn't nearly so poisonous and hostile as it is today. I think there used to be more of a camaraderie within the workforce. But Walmart is incredibly, aggressive about keeping unions out, and any sign that workers are, possibly organizing or even just trying to exert their rights under the law, is they often meet with real pushback and subtle retaliation that makes other workers really think twice about exercising those rights. And if you're in the retail, retail is largely unskilled, and so a lot of folks don't have many choices about where they can work, and particularly in this economy. And so it gives Walmart an enormous advantage to take advantage of people. Just this year, last year, there were, it came out that Walmart had sharply cut back on health benefits for employees. So now far fewer of their workforce are actually eligible to buy into their health plan, which is so expensive that many of them can't afford it, even if they are eligible. So a large number of their workers actually rely on Medicaid and other forms of public assistance to get by. I mean, I think it's one of the ways that we as taxpayers basically subsidize Walmart. I mean, their low prices are low only because a lot of these hidden costs are being picked up by the rest of us, whether you shop there or not. If we really have any hope of changing our economy in the big ways that we really need to change it, one is, of course, is reducing the amount of greenhouse gases that we're creating, which I think is just a pressing crisis. But then next to that is the decline of the middle class and the fact that so many people are slipping into working poverty, where people working full time but not making enough to make ends meet. And I think Walmart is part of both of those problems. And getting the company to change and to sort of change the economic system overall, we really need we really need people to have a voice in the job, and we really need organized labor, in my opinion. And I think, we ought to build more alliances across the environmental and labor spectrum. And I think to sort of dismiss those concerns about what Walmart, how Walmart treats its workforce, isn't a good thing and isn't really helping sort of strategically with these larger problems that we face.
Author and researcher Stacy Mitchell, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was great to be with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Blind Boys of Alabama, Albert King, and Oludara. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.